Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 22, 2016. The French medical charity says the United Nations mission in South Sudan failed to protect civilians during a massacre in Malakal.
There was a mandate, there were the resources, there were the men, and there was a clear, mandate to act and protect civilians in case of attack, and that did not happen. In that sense, it is a failure in our eyes.
And unknown gunmen kidnapped a journalist in Wau.
Six people appeared, and immediately they blindfolded him and took him away. And they were all dressed in black and armed. I did not see anything that albino could be reached to this stage. Since he came from Raja, he spent all these days at home.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The French medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, released a report today evaluating the peacekeeping and humanitarian response following the attack on the Malakal Protection of Civilian Sites in February 17 and 18. MSF's senior humanitarian officer, Monica Di Castellamo, says despite a strong military presence of the peacekeepers at the protection of civilian sites and a clear mandate to protect civilians, the United Nations mission in South Sudan failed in its duty to defend the people living at the site.
Shortly before the event, and particularly during the event, the United Nations mission for South Sudan failed in its mandate to protect the civilians in the site. While the attack was going on, the forces bunkered down and they did not act to stop the violence that was going on in the camp.
You're using a very strong word here, failed. Was this a systemic error or somebody was sleeping on their jobs?
I do not have access to the internal evaluation that the UN has conducted, so I can't really answer on this. But what we can say is that there was no action. So for us, there was a mandate, there were the resources, there were the men, and there was a clear, mandate to act and protect civilians in case of attack, and that did not happen. In that sense, it is a failure in our eyes.
And this mandate that the UN mission in South Sudan has, what chapter is the mission operating under?
It's operating under Chapter 7.
Could you explain that to us more?
It means that they have the right to use force to protect civilians when they come under attack.
To prevent further situations from occurring like that in South Sudan, what is MSF recommending?
This is a big call to prevent further situations. We do not know what the necessary steps are to stop violence in South Sudan. I mean, clearly this is a political objective that the political actors have to address. But what we do say is that at the very least, in the places where there is a confined camp situation, where there are the means and the mandate and the possibility to stop acts of violence, that at the very least that needs to happen. And we also believe that people that have fled to these locations because they felt that it was even less safe outside of these locations, that if they feel that they want to stay here, even if it's a limited protection that they're getting, obviously, that they should be allowed to do so.
When the incident in Malakal happened in February, the UN released a statement saying they acted in self-defense to avoid casualties. In other words, they were saying if the UN peacekeepers had returned fire, a lot of displaced people would have died in the incident. Now, MSF was also helping the wounded people. What is your reaction to that statement?
Well, if you say self-protection, I don't want my people to get hurt, no? So, I mean, if they bunkered down, they did not get into the area where the conflict was happening. They stayed in their corner of the camp, so clearly they avoided their own casualties, if you like. There were many casualties amongst the population, including two of our own staff. A camp was attacked. There were forces coming. Armed men have their ways to somewhat shelter the population from that. I am not a military expert, so I can't say how that needs to happen. But clearly staying locked into your compound is not going to achieve anything.
Moving forward, what should the United Nations peacekeepers do in case they attack again?
From our perspective, this attack and the current situation in Malakal demonstrates two great gaps, both in terms of protection and in terms of assistance. Those gaps are known. It is known that the UN forces could do much more in order to prevent incidents in the camp, in order to mitigate or to mediate when there are small incidents, and more actively prevent anything like this happened, this external attack that was quite unusual. This is not something that hadn't happened before in this way. So the living conditions in the camps are atrocious, and they don't meet minimum agreed standards, humanitarian standards. And by minimum standards, we mean, you know, internationally recognized least necessary, you know, that it's the lowest possible common denominator. So much needs to be done to make to at least ensure that the living conditions are dignified inside the camps.
That's Monica Castellamo, MSF senior humanitarian officer, speaking to me from Barcelona earlier today. Meanwhile, the United Nations Board of Inquiry investigations say two SPLA soldiers were responsible for the immediate trigger of the attacks, which killed 30 internal displaced persons and wounded 123 others. The Board of Inquiry also determined that external armed elements, some in SPLA uniforms, entered the protection of civilian site during the fighting and took part in the violence and destruction of the camp. The South Sudanese government have not arrested anyone for the attack at Malakal or any other serious crimes committed against civilians during the country's recent conflict. In March this year, a government investigation into the Malakal incident concluded that the violence was, quote, instigated by political interest and the failure of UN peacekeepers to arrest the situation as required by their mandate to protect civilians. Human Rights Watch and other advocacy groups have repeatedly urged the African Union to speed up the establishment of a hybrid court as spelled out in the August peace agreement to try most serious crimes committed during the conflict. A journalist working for South Sudan Radio and Television in Wau was kidnapped from his family house early this morning. Six armed men came and took Albino Andrea to an unknown location. Albino works as the official cameraman for Governor Rizik Zakaria in Lowell State. He fled to Wau along several government officials on Saturday following a deadly attack on Raja last week. His father, who witnessed the ordeal, told South Sudan in Focus he does not know the whereabouts of his son. Michael Atit reports from Wau.
Andrea Jovi Sakar is the father of the kidnapped journalist. Jovi says six armed men stormed into his compound at dawn and kidnapped his son. He says Albino has been devoted to his work and has never harmed anyone. Speaking in Arabic, he describes what happened this morning.
At around 3 a.m., I heard a voice of a person calling, "Albino, Albino." So, as the father, I decided to come out and ask, "Who is calling Albino?" I did not see anybody. So when Albino came out, six people appeared, and immediately they blindfolded him and took him away. And they were all dressed in black and armed. I did not see anything that Albino could be reached to this stage. Since he came from Raja, he spent all these days at home.
Albino has served as the official cameraman in the governor's office of the former Western Barrel Ghazali state since 2012. He moved to Raja with Governor Rizik Zakaria when President Salva Kiir annexed Raja to Awil to form the new Lol state. Albino fled from Raja after unknown gunmen attacked the governor's residence and looted a bank last Wednesday. Alor Kurdeng heads the Union of Journalists of South Sudan in Wau. Speaking in Arabic to reporters in Wau this afternoon, Kur urged the kidnappers to release Albino immediately.
We as the Union of Journalists in Wau, we are calling upon those who kidnapped Albino to release him as soon as possible and should not be subjected to any form of violence to his body.
2 days ago, the press secretary for the Lol State Governor, Joseph Gabriel Mali, reported to the UJO's office in Wau that he has been threatened by a text message from an unidentified telephone number. claimed that the text messages accused him of helping Governor Rizik Zakaria escape from Rajatown. Albino's father says the family has reported the case to the authorities in Wau. South Sudan in Focus contacted the police in Wau for comment, but the police declined to comment on Albino's kidnapping. Recently, the Committee to Protect Journalists issued a statement condemning the killing of five journalists in Wau. The journalists were killed when an identified gunman ambushed an official convoy escorting the commissioner who was traveling from Wau to Rajatown. No arrests were made and the perpetrators are still at large. Another journalist working for the UN-sponsored Miraya FM station in Wau was detained by South Sudan's National Security in August 2014. Family members of George Livio Bahara have been prevented from visiting him. Livio's father told reporters earlier this year that his son was on leave at the time of his arrest. A representative of the UNMISS national staff says Livio should still be afforded privilege and immunity that are extended to UN personnel. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
Mismanagement of finances in South Sudan has been one of the biggest problems facing the country. While state and national officials have attempted to fight corruption, one watchdog group says South Sudanese lawmakers should seek the help of Western governments to fight corruption on a large scale. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Presidential spokesman Atenua Katen is playing down a statement by the Washington-based Enough Project, which said President Salva Kiir's office has not effectively followed through on promises to tackle corruption in the country. The NGO says corruption has largely continued unabated for years and stolen assets are still missing. Aten says the country's corruption problem has a direct impact on the ongoing economic crisis.
The problem is, you know, as the government is struggling now to pay, civil servants, you know, on time, as the economic situation, you know, started to worsen, it looked like some institutions within the government are overwhelmed because there are no finances to build the capacity of the institutions to enable them to be able to record and make sure that all the government employees are to adhere to the regulations.
16 people were sentenced to life in prison last week after a South Sudanese court found them guilty of stealing more than $14 million U.S. dollars from President Kiir's office between 2013 and 2015. Those convicted include former staff members with the Ministry of Finance, the Central Bank, and four Kenyans. Brian Adeba of the Washington-based Enough Project says the decision was a first step, but the government can and should do more.
Since South Sudan became independent, the National Audit Chamber has not produced any audits of government since 2011. So government has no idea of how its money was spent and what actions it needs to take to rectify any steps that were taken to by officials to misappropriate money or misspend money. So we need that as a benchmark. We need these autonomous institutions to be given the power to do what they need to do to hold people accountable.
Aten says the 2.5-year conflict has made it difficult to make any progress.
It is only the implementations, because we are in a situation, we were in a war, and that whoever is asked to recover the government, the public assets or public money, you know, sometimes they may think to rebel against the country. And so the government was overwhelmed by the war that was being fought.
Adeba says U.S. resources and legislative tools like the Justice Department's kleptocracy initiative can help trace most transactions carried out in U.S. dollars. And he says South Sudanese authorities also have resources at their disposal, like the Anti-Corruption Commission.
The Anti-Corruption Commission has come up with cases of people reportedly, allegedly accused of misappropriating government money. For starters, we should be seeing, I think, these people going through the justice system to establish the veracity of their criminality.
Last week's verdict of life in prison for former corrupt officials drew mixed reactions from civil society groups. Some welcomed the decision, while others believed the life sentences were too strict. Earlier this year, the U.S. Special Envoy's office to Sudan and South Sudan said managing the country's finances should be a top priority in the transitional government of national unity. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, traders in WoW refuse to open their shops while judges are on strike. We'll explain why after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how often do you dance?
Oh, daily. I dance daily. I exercise daily. I made it a habit these days. I have now 2 weeks I'm going on a roll. I wake up in the morning, I exercise, I dance, I put music in my own house. Then I go to work.
And even when we are singing praising songs, I also enjoy dancing. And at times when I'm bored alone, when I don't have people, I try to dance. Yeah. No, not daily, but once in a while, more special on Sundays.
And not often, once in a blue moon. I don't really like it, so once in a blue moon, I just dance.
I think twice a week when I play music or instruments, and then on Sundays when I go to church and then there's praise and worship, yes, I dance.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Traders in WoW have kept their shops closed since Monday following a nationwide strike by judges. Shop owners say thieves could take advantage of the absence of judiciary to loot shops. Consumers say the closure of the shops is affecting families who depend on food from the market. Michael Atit reports from WoW.
Businessmen and women in WoW say it is not safe to operate when the country's judiciary is not functioning. Some traders say criminals might take advantage of the situation to break into their shops at night. For the last 2 days, the judges' strike has had the kind of residual effect on shop traders and consumers who say they cannot go about their business without a functioning judiciary. Sudanese trader Bakri Omar owns a hardware store in WoW's Joe Market. He closed his shop for 2 days. Speaking in Arabic, Omar says he too is afraid to open his store.
The strike of judges have an immediate effect on our business because we believe that the judiciary is the mother of all laws. And if the court is not functioning, if my good is robbed or stolen, where do I go? Who will give me back my right? That is why I decide to keep my shop closed. That was the only fear I had.
37-year-old Sefadin Hasaballa owns a grocery store in High Jebel residential area of WoW. Hasaballa says he also kept his shop closed since Monday. Speaking in Arabic, Hasaballa says unknown people broke into his shop 2 weeks ago and stole 2 sacks of sugar and wheat worth thousands of South Sudanese pounds.
What we need the government to provide is security. If the security is provided, we do not have any problem. I cannot risk and open my business place and lose my money. I will be forced to close. There is no other way. I call on the authorities to give us security, and we will offer good services to the local community.
On Monday, shops remain closed in WoW. Military police are stationed in Sukjou to watch over the market. 43-year-old Asunta Gabriel, a mother of 6 children, says she was diagnosed with a high blood pressure, but she could not get her medicine because all the pharmacies were closed down. Speaking in Arabic, she says many sick people like her are suffering from a lack of medicine. Gabriel says she checked her blood pressure and it was very high. She says she did not have any medicine with her. I sent my children to buy it, but they could not find any pharmacy open. I really suffered, Gabriel said. WoW state authorities met with traders this week to discuss the concerns of the business community in WoW town. State Governor Elias Waya Nyipoch assured traders that security forces are ready to protect traders. Speaking in Arabic, Waya says traders should still report cases of robbery to the police during the strike by judges. He says state authorities will punish criminals who take advantage of the judges' strike.
We have been trying in the past days to make sure all your business places keep operating, because I know some of you have lost a lot of money, and some of you were working in the affected areas and came to the town to start life again. We are aware of this, but we are working hard to make sure security situation comes to normal.
Judges across South Sudan have been on strike since the beginning of the week to demand improvement of their work conditions, payment of allowances, and back salaries. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
There is an outbreak of Jigas infection among South Sudanese refugees in the Boyale resettlement camps. Health officials say Jigas can be eliminated by living in a clean environment. Reporter Bonifacio Taban traveled to Boyale resettlement camp and spoke to parents struggling to keep the parasite off the feet and hands of their children, and has this report for VOA.
Jigas are small sand flea found in sub-Saharan climate and are also most prominent during dry season. Jigas are persistent burrowers and are also known in the scientific community as sugar flea. The parasite live in soil and sand but feed on warm blood hosts, especially human and animal. 28-year-old Mary Ismail wake up every morning and immediately pull out Jigas from the toes and finger of her children. She said he does this every day before he starts her other activities. Ismail said each day he removes up to 5 or 6 Jigas from the feet and finger of her 6 children. She said getting rid of Jigas is not easy.
When we go to hospital, they are tell us that you go and watch it. They don't give any medicine and they don't do anything to us. Just to send us back home, you go and use the water and tie them with a kafir.
Ismail's children spend most of their time at home. Ismail said they are not able to go to school because of the damage caused by Jigas on their feet.
From last year is somehow, but for this year they did not go to school from the first term up to the end of.
The majority of South Sudanese refugees staying at Biala resettlement camp live in poverty and cannot even afford to buy shoes. Speaking in Arabic, Mary Nyakwazungwan said, the UN refugees agencies should supply medicine to help the refugees treat Jigas. She said, at this time, after they arrived here early in 2014, the people here told them, for the treatment of Jigas, you have to keep your house clean and put everything under sun heat. We have tried that, but it does not work. We are urging the UNHCR to step in and supply us with medicines. An official in the office of Uganda Prime Minister, who spoke off the record, told BOA similar cases of Jigas have affected a huge number of refugees residing at the camp in Uganda. A doctor in Uganda Kampala International Hospital would only identify himself as a Dr. Joseph because he is not authorized to speak to the media, said Jigas only affect low-income people like refugees. He said Jigas can only be avoided by improving hygiene and providing thorough medical attention to those suffering from Jigas infestation. Dr. Joseph said Jigas can be treated with anesthetic, which is poured in a plastic basin. The legs and hands of a person infected with Jigas is then immersed into the liquid for a few minutes to kill the eggs and the flea. He said this treatment can only be done at a hospital with experts, because the medicine can cause dizziness and general body weakness among patients. For VOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban, reporting in Kampala.
Still on medical issues, a medical officer in Jonglei State Hospital says there's been a sharp increase in the number of cases of hepatitis B in the state capital, Bor. Doctors say the only way to prevent the spread of hepatitis B virus is by testing and vaccinating residents. Jacob Achek has this story for VOA from Bor.
Bor State Hospital records indicate that out of 900 people who were tested last year, 109 people were diagnosed with the hepatitis B virus. Hepatitis B is a liver disease that resulted from an infection with the hepatitis B virus. Severity can vary from a mild illness lasting a few weeks to a serious, life-longing illness Hepatitis B is usually spread through blood, semen, or other body fluid from an infected person. This can happen through sexual contact with an infected person or sharing needles, syringes, or other drug injection equipment. Hepatitis B can also be passed from an infected mother to her baby at birth. Dr. Yag Jurkuc is the medical officer at Bor Civil Hospital. He says most of the patients who come to the hospital because their liver was malfunctioning test positive for hepatitis B.
So far, we've seen an increase, and I cannot really put a figure on how many people we receive per day who need the test. But for the last 2 months, there has been four in the first month, that was April, and then six patients in the month of May, the whole month, that were positive for hepatitis B. And that is, to me, compared to the long time ago, is a bit of an increase.
He says some patients with serious cases have been referred to Juba for further medical treatment. Medical experts say symptoms of the disease vary depending on patient's immune system. The most common symptoms are headaches, fever, chest pain, and or vomiting. Jurkuc says significant weight loss is also one of the signs of hepatitis B.
Most of the times, for those early stages, it is asymptomatic. You don't see any symptoms. But as time goes by, it starts to destroy your liver. And once it has started to destroy your liver, the functions that your liver used to do, like processing food and other stuff, are diminished.
Bor resident Agnes, who was tested for hepatitis B, says it is important to vaccinate against the disease.
I was tested in Juba Medical Complex. They found me hepatitis B negative, and they injected me 2 months ago. And currently now, and I will be going also for a third injection. The first injection is not that much active, but the second injection is active. Third injection, then you have prevent the hepatitis B or hepatitis A, because there are more type of hepatitis.
Simon Nyok is a laboratory supervisor at Bor Hospital. He says the best way of preventing the disease is to avoid and safe sexual intercourse and contact with bodily fluids.
The best thing to do is to avoid sharing clothing with somebody who is hepatitis B positive. And not only that, even if you know this person is free from hepatitis B or any other infection, please, please avoid sharing clothing, because you may never know. There are people who are hepatitis B positive, but they don't present any signs and symptoms at all.
Resident Samuel Kucha says the public should listen to doctors' advice.
Let us prevent ourselves from this disease, because it is danger. If you got it, there will be no treatment at all. Don't make any sexual with any woman. If you are a man, please wed your wife. If you are not married, please wed your son.
Hepatitis A and C are not serious like hepatitis B and E, which attack the liver. Dr. Yag Jurkuc says government hospitals have hepatitis B vaccines at most early centers around the country. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
That's our show for this Wednesday. I am John Tanza in Washington. We now leave you with the song Let Me Go by Talis. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.